won't do that.
All right, let's get out of here. All right, guys, let's rock here. Thanks, ladies. All right, next reading here. Next, my most fun part here is the, I can't make this name out. It looks like Michelle Mayer. Okay. That's my eyes are bad. Michelle Mayer. Michelle, where you at, honey? Kid, Michelle, I know you're someone. Come on, Michelle. Couldn't even see.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to Jimmy and to Joan for organizing this and giving us an opportunity to listen to one another and to read our poems. I remember so well being a senior in high school. I went to Upper St. Clair High School and saying to a friend in the cafeteria, I will never get married. I will never have children. I will never live in Pittsburgh. And I live in Wexford, happily married with three children. And so often growing up, I was determined to go away and not really carry those roots in a way. And yet I find when I write poetry that Pittsburgh plays a great part in that effort. This poem is entitled Carousel, and it's rooted in an experience I had at Kennywood. And I think one of my fatal flaws is believing what people tell me, especially people I love. And this is about an interaction I had with my brother. Carousel. When I was little, sweaty with sugar and grime in the long line looping around the carousel, my brother told me snakes live in the belly of the wooden merry-go-round horses, and that if I put my hand in the mouth of one as I rode, a snake would dart out between the horse's large yellowing teeth, curling lips, and bite me. 40 years later, I still move gingerly as I ride the carousel and reach forward to place my fingers on my horse's lips, then my own. This was a poem that I was working on in the past few weeks, starting a garden. Cooler hours. I wander out to the balloon flowers, blue and swollen, opening into a haze of focused, determined bees. Once I thought that I knew that I would know what I was doing, or at least to credibly fake it, so comfortable in my skin that I would dissolve into the motions of each hour. I water the blooms in the heat of late afternoon when most of the water burns off, but some remains, sustaining them until cooler hours. One of the things I look for in poets whose work I love is how to deal with difficult emotions without sentimentality. I think because I'm given to self-pity in my own life that I try to strip out the whining as much as I can in the poems. But I always find that a particular challenge. This poem is entitled Bright Air Settling Around Us. I go to greet my older sister at our dying father's bedside. Early evening light washes his bedroom with a soft gold, and once again, I'm 2 years old. I'm rooting in the garden in front of our apartment on a summer afternoon, searching among wilted tulip stalks for my father's black horn-rimmed glasses. My sister and I, both in our 50s, haven't spoken to or seen each other in 18 years. I have found them before, behind a sofa, under a desk. I crouch, grab hold, and call out. Babe, you have eyes like a hawk, he says, hoisting me to his shoulder, bright air settling around us. I've prepared what I'm going to say. You have our father's eyes. I'm glad to see you. This is Dad, she says, pointing to her chest. You're not welcome here. Thank you.
should be just two poems. Two poems, two pages.
I just got one poem for you that's two pages. All right. It's a bit lyrical. It's depressing, and then it's triumphant. That's really all I can do to describe it, but you should. It's quite humorous as well. It's called A Day in the Life of a Man Who Sucked at Everything. Ben Blows was the worst man to have ever lived and the worst man to have ever died. He was awful at everything and failed at anything he ever tried. He tried to paint, but all he ever made were sloppy strokes. He tried to make people laugh, but fell flat on his face with humorless jokes. He was a living wreck, as tedious and useless as can be, pallid and dull, a total pity. His very existence was that of misery. Even his surname was horrid, Blows it was, and it was nothing but a point of ridicule, but accurate enough. He tried to shake it, pronounce it a different way, but his actions only helped his unconventional name to stay. As a little boy, Ben tried to fit in with his classmates, but never could. They found him laughable and as interesting as a block of wood. He was no athlete. He couldn't hit a ball if he tried. Always the last pick for the teams. Team captains accepted him with terrible sighs. He thought with some time he'd learn to draw, but his pictures were messes on paper and as exciting as a clean white wall. When he hit his teens, he tried to start a band, but he was no left-handed Jimi Hendrix. He couldn't play guitar with either hand. So he tried to sing. He reached for the highs and growled in his lows. Freddie Mercury he was not on, in any stage he froze. He couldn't play the bass. Those four strings were just too tough. And on drums he pounded and pounded, but just couldn't keep up. He tried to be an actor, but he was awfully reviewed. So he tried his hand as a writer, but to the page could keep no one glued. Last he tried to direct, but he was just no good. His work had made an Orson Welles out of even Ed Wood. With art out of the way, he tried to run a shop, but he was no more qualified to helm a business than he was to hold a mop. The business failed and he lost all his cash. He couldn't manage his money, he couldn't even take out the trash. Business failed, he turned to construction, but he bent every nail and caused only destruction. Next, he tried to sell things, but he was no Billy Mays. He never managed to sell one product in 30 whole days. Down on his luck and feeling quite bad, Ben contemplated his life and every experience he had ever had. He realized that in 20-some years he had never done anything right, though he worked so hard and tried with all his might. He read all the right books, got the best of educations, and watched all his peers honored with standing ovations. "When will it be my time?" he cried. "When will I find my place?" He looked deep in the mirror and reflected, "I don't even have a pleasant face." Ben counted his savings and bought a gun. He put it under his chin and whimpered, "Goodbye, life, it's not been fun." Then it hit him. This was his call. He dropped the gun and stood proud and tall. "I'm the worst man that ever lived," he shouted. "No one's worse than me, and if they say they are, why, I severely doubt it. I've tried it all, and I'm total shit. This shall be my legacy, my great claim to fame. With my awful face and my awful brain, the world will have no choice but to know my awful name." He started a website, WorstManAlive.com, put his face on t-shirts and magnets from New York to Vietnam. With a little help, he wrote a book about how much he sucked, sold well over a million copies about how much he had failed, and soon a sequel about how in the face of nothing he had prevailed. Ben was on the up and up. He had it all. Women, money, his likeness on a best-selling doll. Ben took pleasure in being a loser and now knew the joy it could bring. He sat back and smiled, a day in the life of a man who sucked at everything.
Well, I brought two poems, both written in form, because I often find that either the deeply serious or the utterly silly work best in a form. So the first one, and you'll see why I chose it, just because of the timer of the particular holiday we've just had. Vietnam Memorial. And this is an Elizabethan sonnet. Perfumed twilight, balmy early May, the mole's new green on broken waves of grass, no longer thronged with tourists out to play. Now lights like will-o'-the-wisp beckon my way between the two memorials, death en masse, black marble slabs wedged in the sod and clay. Two dates and many thousand names I pass. Parents instruct their children war's no game. A friend from school days drafted to his doom. Lest we forget, they've deeply etched his name. For offerings free soon wither in the gloom. Sorry, for offerings fresh soon wither in the gloom. Blinded by tears, a woman grieves in vain. Inverted braille, frail fingers trace her pain. And then moving up from the Elizabethan form to 18th century Homeric similes and poetic diction. The wages of greed are the spar. A trim Artemis sizes up her class. Our wanton appetites made flesh, alas. After the stretch, the leg and flabby thigh, we work them in and out, first low, then high. Next come the sit-ups. What a cruel jest. Our flaccid muscles burn to pass the test. Breathe out, she cries, to tuck all those tummies in. Think twice before committing chocolate sin. At last the hour is drawing to a close. We're back to stretching, fingertips to toes. Good work, eat light, her final admonition follows us as we leap in full contrition into the Hellespont to swim our laps, though thoughts are focused on postprandial naps. Then in the whirlpool calms our aching limbs, Charybdis tamed, the painful memory dims. Conspirators, we muse about which beast, basted with sauce, awaits our noontide feast.
When people say history repeats itself, we're thinking back to what were we doing now that happened in the past. But there's a lot of times it's what's happening now that thought I had something there, but I didn't. At any rate, you'll get the idea. Getting the mule's attention. 1935. Roosevelt passes legislation to ensure crop rotation, grass seeding, and new plowing methods, all made possible by dust. Dust that rolled 2,000 miles from Oklahoma, South Dakota, Kansas, and New Mexico to blind and choke New Yorkers, where it limited visibility to 3 feet up and beyond the Empire State Building. To D.C., where the same visual limits engulfed the Capitol's building's reluctant senators, enabling Hugh Bennett, in his plea for better soil preservation practices, to point out a window and declare, "There goes Oklahoma," thus enabling the senators to see he had a point.
This one's in memory of my dad. The last obstacle finally overcome. Here, high up the slopes of that last mountain, that mountain rising beyond deep blue into black, where the air is thin and getting thinner, you need to pause every few moments for breath. How many times have you watched this unfold from below? Now it is your turn. Come so soon, though not suddenly, and others are watching. A breath and another breath, life's little summations. It is about breath now, nothing else. You have made your farewells quietly, as is your way, so quietly they have yet to be noticed. All the old arguments are finished, all the opinions, all the stances. Rasping, keeping departure at bay just a little longer. You summon the gathered patience of decades and wait for a moment, the perfect moment when the room is at last empty, the perturbed air at last still, the audience departed, the audience for whom you have saved your final courtesy.